Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is great to have your company as always. Now, we all know that as business owners, our role or part of our role is to lead the team. And that means that we need to be at our best, not just for our team, but for our patients and everyone with whom we interact. But of course, that means taking great care of ourselves. And my guest today, Dr. Jenny Brockes, is an expert in that. She's authored several books, and her most recent book is called Thriving Mind. And what I really love about this particular book is the subtitle, which is How to Cultivate a Good Life. And of course, we're in business to create a practice and a life that we love for ourselves. So it is important that we do take care of ourselves. So in this conversation, we really focus a lot on self-care, how to make sure that we're at our best so that we can fit our own oxygen mask so that we can then help and support other people in our life, whether that be patients, whether that be team, or anyone in between. And so what we talk about in this particular episode, well, we talk about a lot of things actually, but we talk specifically about burnout. We talk about what burnout is, how to avoid it, but particularly if you're at risk of burnout, how to spot those early signs so that you can make sure you get back on track and take good care of yourself before you do hit the wall. Jenny shares very openly about her experience with burnout. I've experienced burnout myself in my early 30s to mid 30s. And I can tell you that if I'd known some of the information that Jenny shares today back then, it would have been a simpler and easier process to sort out. Now, apart from burnout, we talk a lot about what brain health is. And we talk about why that's so important and some of the things that we can do to keep our neurons in the best possible shape so that we're in the best possible shape, not just for ourselves, but as I said, for others as well. This is a wide-ranging interview. We talk about lots of different stuff. And as I said a moment ago, Jenny shares very openly her own stories, her own background, but importantly, she shares the evidence and what really works, what's been shown to work effectively so that we can be at our best to help others as well. So I really hope you get a lot out of this episode. There's tons in it. You're going to want to have a pen and paper handy. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jenny as much as I did. Dr. Jenny Brockes, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us all the way from Perth. How are you today?
I'm really well, thanks, Jesse.
Oh, well, I'm really looking forward to talking to you because there's a lot of stuff that we're going to dive into, but specifically, you've just authored a new book called Thriving Mind, How to Cultivate a Good Life. And you've got a background as a general practitioner, so you've come from that medical background and you've written this book. I just wanted to ask you, why? Why write the book? What was the impetus? What was the drive to write that book? Obviously, to sit down and to pen a book requires a good, strong motivation. And I'm curious to understand what got you to that point.
I have to say, when you're writing a book, you do question yourself frequently. Why am I doing this? It's such a lot of work. It takes forever. Why did I write the book? Well, it came over a period of time. I had actually written a couple of other books before, and they'd been sort of more straightforward. I'd had my medical hat on. I was talking about brain health, cognition, productivity, that sort of thing. And then in a book that a publisher picked up in 2015 called Future Brain, it really sort of started to allow me to expand my thinking into what we do on a daily basis and how that influences our outcomes. And they were then pestering me, saying, come on, Jenny, when are you going to write your next book? And I was saying, I'm not ready. I don't know what to write. Anyway, I started sharing a personal story about a time when I burnt out. And I was doing this in conferences and in workshops. And the response was quite unsettling. It was unsettling because people really resonated with it. I would have people come up to me afterwards saying, Jenny, it was as if you were speaking to me. I know exactly what you went through. I have experienced that too. Or the other thing would be, I think I'm burning out and I don't know what to do. Can you give me some advice? So I'd unleashed something in that side of my work. And so eventually I decided, right, I'm going to put this in writing. So help.
Yeah.
Because being a professional, being a medic, where, I mean, let's face it, medics are horribly judgmental of each other. I'd kept my story very quiet for a long time because I feared that judgment. I feared being seen as weak or call yourself a doctor. Don't you know, you know, you need to sort of just gird your loins and carry on with stuff. But it was that very trait in myself, because I'd always been a high achiever, bit of a perfectionist, always wanted to be of service of others, that had led me to burnout. And I never saw it coming, because I had been trained through medical school and thereafter that being a medic was tough. Being a medic required you to dig deep, to soldier on, to never give up, because, you know, you were of service to others. But I just took it too far because I was blind to the fact that I was human and had limits. I wrote the book basically as a cautionary tale, not just to doctors, but for anybody, because burnout can affect men, women, grown-ups, and children. I was horrified when I realized that burnout can affect kids too. So, you know, we need to be kinder to ourselves, more compassionate, and to recognize that because we're human, we're fallible, we're vulnerable, we stuff up, we make mistakes, and that's okay. So it's a huge lesson.
There's a lot in there, Jenny. There's a ton in there. And thank you for giving me lots of threads that I can, it's like a jumper with lots of loose threads. I can pull on these little threads and see where we go. So thank you for that. Yeah. When you said that as a doctor, you're used to being a high achiever, a perfectionist, being of service to others, that applies equally to dentists as well. Pretty much every dentist I know is type A personality, high achiever, somewhere on the perfectionistic scale, usually at the extreme end somewhere, because if you're not perfectionistic, you become perfectionistic because precision work and so on. We tend to be very harsh critics of our own work as well. We tend to be really hard on ourselves. We can be more forgiving of other people than ourselves oftentimes.
Yes. Yeah.
I assume that's very similar for doctors and probably some other professions as well. So I want to ask you about that unique set of attributes and what does that type of person live with on a day-to-day basis that makes them perhaps a little more susceptible to burnout or some other sorts of elements of burnout that perhaps someone who's less perfectionistic might experience?
Obviously, it depends on the individual.
Of course.
But I know for me, I was constantly stressed. And I didn't appreciate, I mean, everybody's stressed, right? Because we say, oh, I'm so stressed. But I was actually living with a lot of stress that was actually manifesting itself as a low-grade chronic anxiety. But I never acknowledged it or was really aware of it. I just thought everybody was like that. But it wasn't until longer down the track that I discovered that actually, no, that's not true. That was just me. So I think the thing about doctors and dentists and other health professionals, especially when we're running our own business, there's very high expectations that we place on ourselves because it's our business, it's our baby, which is slightly different from when you're working for an employer. Now, I'm sure you've worked for employers as well as I have, and sometimes that high expectation does come from elsewhere, the external sources or your peers. But I think those are the traits that set us up for burnout.
Do you think part of the issue as well is how our identity is tied to what we do, in a sense? Is that part of the issue, do you think?
Ooh, that digs a bit deep, Jesse. Yes. In a nutshell, I live for my work. I describe myself as a recovering workaholic. I love my job. I love what I do, but I loved it too much. I became my work. My whole identity was my work. So learning to reconnect with those other facets of who I was part of the healing process later down, later on. And it's so important because when you get, and I hear other people say, oh, Jenny, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Burnout must be dreadful, but it's never going to apply to me because I love my job too much. And I'm thinking, whoa, stop there.
Red flag.
Yeah, big red flags. Because when you love your job too much, you give up and you sacrifice everything else in order to fulfill that desire. And the more you fuel it, the fiercer that fire burns until you burn out. So I think it's really about remembering that relationships matter. Why is it so many people in professions end up in divorce courts? Why is it so many people in professions find that, you know, they retire and they've got nothing else in their life to do? They're at a loss because they've forgotten how to have fun and play and do all those other things that, you know, make us interesting as people. If you can only talk about work, you become a bore. I mean, who wants to go to a dinner party and listen to somebody going nah, 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 about their work all night long? One of my friends said to me after I burnt out, she said, Jenny, you're so much more fun to have at dinner parties. You used to pass out. I was so tired all the time by 9 o'clock. So I was really out of it. She said that, no, we can see the real Jenny now. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
It is an interesting insight. Hmm. And I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this who are either able to relate to this or have someone very close to them that might have experienced this as well. And one of the things that I've spoken to quite a few people about who have experienced similar sorts of things is when you say reconnecting to things that are fun, things that you like to do that are not work related, I hear a lot of people say, I can't remember what they are, or there is nothing else. And so I guess for someone listening to this show and who might be having that thought, how does one reconnect with those things or indeed discover what they were in the first place? If it's been so long that those enjoyment, you know, elements of life have atrophied, how do you rediscover that or create them?
For me, it was trying out things that I hadn't done before. So whether it was making a mosaic or doing still life drawing or something like that, all those things that I used to enjoy in school, but of course lost because I was diverted along the science path. So I was, had to give those up. Music had always been a big part of my life, especially as being a teenager. And yet I stopped listening to music a long time ago, even the radio. You know, I'd listen to the news, but I wouldn't listen to those songs that used to sort of give me pleasure and that I'd sing along to as I was driving along. And I also challenged myself to learn new skills just to see whether, because I didn't know what to do after I'd lost my practice as a result of burning out. And so I was trying to find something that was totally unrelated to medicine because I never wanted to cross that threshold again because look what it did to me. It made me sick. And so I tried a number of different things over a year or two before I realized that actually I did love medicine and I did love looking after people, but I wanted to do it differently. I wanted to do it my way. So for me, it was just trial and error until I found the right thing. And for me, that was setting up my own consultancy. So I'm a solopreneur. I work as a workplace health consultant, if you like, where I go into people's workplaces, usually at the request of HR or the CEO, or somebody's heard me speak somewhere and they say, oh, Jenny, you'd be great to come and talk to us about X, Y, or Z. So I sort of set up this new life of speaking in public. Now, that was a new skill.
Yeah.
I was very good one-on-one. Hey, but, you know, put me in a room of people and get me to stand up and say something. You know, I'd be blushing from my roots to my feet and going all tongue-tied. So I had to learn public speaking. I had to learn how to run workshops, all these things. But the pleasure aspect was getting outside and exploring my own neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The first thing I got to learn was how beautiful our suburb was. I discovered all these little pockets of parks that I never knew were there because I'd always been busy going to work. And we got a dog. We hadn't had a pet before. And the dog needed a walk. So every day I was out walking the dog and we would explore and we'd go to all these different places. And I quickly realized that this was actually making me feel so much better because I was out in nature and there's so much going for spending time outside. Just doesn't matter what the weather's like, whether it's sunny or cloudy or rainy or whatever, just being outside, seeing what's around you, especially if it's in a green space, is enormously beneficial for our mental well-being. And the other thing that I discovered last year, actually, because I was talking to somebody and she said, Jenny, what do you do for fun? And there was this rather embarrassing pause as I was struggling again. I thought, oh, yeah, the walking, swimming. And she said, I think you could do a bit more research here. And I thought, yes, I can. So I went home, went onto the laptop and thought, fun. Let's type in F for fun. And swing dancing came up.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, I've always wanted to learn swing dancing. So I gave my husband the very good news that we had been signed up for swing dancing classes because you weren't allowed to do them without a partner because it was in the time of lockdowns and you weren't allowed to sort of associate. Yeah. So anyway, we went along and we've both fallen in love with swing dancing. And, you know, we look forward to the classes every week. We haven't been able to do them recently because of further lockdowns. But that is fun. It doesn't matter how good you are or how bad you are. It's just the pure joy of moving your body to music. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't. Doesn't matter. But it is pure pleasure. And we always come home with a big smile on our face, feeling absolutely exhausted, trying to sort of learn all the different steps.
I love that. That's fantastic. Your husband. Guess what? Surprise.
Yeah, hey, surprise.
Surprise. Yay. Guess what? Hey, I wanted to ask you because I know in your writing and your speaking, you use the word brain health.
Yes.
And it's a really interesting phrase. Because most of us don't really think about the health of our brain.
We don't.
And so I wanted to ask, what do you mean by brain health? And then how do we cultivate brain health? It sounds like a good thing. Like to have a healthy brain sounds like a good thing. So what does it mean and how do we work towards that?
Well, brain health is essential to optimal brain function, which means, you know, how we think, learn and remember. But of course, it's all the other components that our brain sort of regulates and allows us to perform. But most of us are concerned with, you know, the state of our heart, our blood pressure, our weight, things like that. And we don't give our brains a second thought until we get to that stage in our lives where we're maturing nicely. And then you realize that you're not remembering things as quickly as you used to. You're not quite as sharp. You have those embarrassing lapses or tip of the tongue moments. And you start to worry about Alzheimer's and different forms of dementia. Mm. And that seems to be the time when most people actually give their brains a thought. Or if they've been injured in a road accident and they've had a traumatic brain injury, or if they've had a stroke, or if they've had some other theme affect their brain, then they become aware of it. But for most people, no, don't give it a second thought. So brain health is part and parcel, part of holistic health and well-being, so that it's about doing those things, making those lifestyle choices that the neuroscience and the behavioral science have shown that allow us to function at our best. So you've got the smarts, you've got the degree, you know what you're capable of, but if you're sleeping really badly, you're an emotional wreck because you're going through a relationship breakup, you've been eating total crap and drinking far too much wine for the last whatever period of time, your brain's going to be affected by that. So it's about sort of recognizing what helps you to bring your best self to everything you do on a daily basis. So it incorporates physical health. It incorporates mental health as well. But brain health is specifically, what do I do to make sure that my neurons are supplied with the right nutrients, the right sort of level of neurotransmitters to enable me to think well, think clearly, make good decisions, solve problems, and use my executive function well. In a nutshell, does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I guess if we were to start thinking about habits that support brain health, you've touched on one or two with sleeping and so on and so forth. And I guess to that point, how important is rest and sleep to brain health? I'm curious to understand that. Sleep is one of those, seems to be at least to me, a very rapidly emerging field of medicine and science as well. Yes. And so I'm curious to ask what the role of sleep is, but then again, what other factors contribute to brain health?
So no surprises really. It's healthy nutrition.
Yep.
The right mindset. What you know, your attitude does make a huge difference to how you approach things, your world perspective on things. It's your ability to challenge your brain, because we have a neuroplastic brain, which enables us to be lifelong learners. So the more we challenge it and the more we learn new skills or upskill and get better at using our brain in the way it was designed, the better it gets. So go for that. It's about physical activity. Notice I didn't use the E word. And it's the role of sleep.
Yeah.
Effective stress management, being social, social interaction, and the closeness of your most intimate relationships are huge to brain health. And of course, looking after your general physical well-being. I mean, there are so many factors that have been identified as to what prevents cognitive decline, which includes looking after your blood pressure, keeping to a healthy weight, not smoking, moderate alcohol intake, those sort of things. There's lots to it, but it's all the stuff we know. It's just the stuff we don't do.
Why don't we do it?
Because we prioritize other things like work first, basically. And certainly as a doctor, I was always trained to look for a diagnosis of what was wrong, what was broken, what needed fixing. And there, I was never trained to think about, well, what can I do, having restored this person to health and well-being, to enable them to maintain that? And I think the tide is now shifting, where many more health professionals in a wide array of different backgrounds are now practicing what's called lifestyle medicine. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've heard the term, but I haven't explored the term.
So it's basically a much more holistic approach, where if somebody came to see me and they said, I think I'm depressed, I would say, okay, tell me about what's going on for you, but tell me also about your sleep habits, what you're eating, how much exercise you're doing, what's going on in your workplace, all those other things which may have contributed to the development of the depression, and can, when unpacked and dealt with, help to alleviate that person's symptoms and give them the tools they need to stop the depression from coming back.
I mean, that's a really interesting, and it's a big topic. We could spend probably weeks just talking about depression and mental health, mental well-being, et cetera.
Yeah.
But of course, my understanding, and I'm not a professional in this area at all, but what I've read in various forms of literature is that depression is often attributed as a chemical imbalance.
Mm.
And I guess what I'm hearing you say is that that balance of chemistry is affected by all those other elements in your life. So we might someone might take some form of medicine to restore the chemical balance.
Yes.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, and I may not be, so please set me straight if I've got it wrong, is while that's important to restore, we may not want to rely on that forever. And we've got to go back and look at the root cause of things rather than just trying to keep putting the Band-Aid on.
Yeah, because two reasons. One, we've got a growing, what they call, burden of chronic medical disease. Mm. We're now seeing for the first time our longevity starting to shorten because of that. Yes, because for so long, we've been thinking, oh, we're going to be living longer and living longer and living longer, and I'm going to be 150 before I die, that sort of thing. And now, because so many more younger people are developing chronic medical disease, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, all these sort of things, they're now living shorter lives than their parents. Not all of them, obviously, but that's the trend.
Yeah, wow.
And that's A, not affordable. Medicare can't support that. Mm. We're already at sort of crisis levels with trying to manage those sort of maladies of modern life, I call them. Mm. And it's not sustainable. And as far as mental illness goes, we are seeing a system on its knees. I mean, pre-COVID, the mental health system was failing us badly because it didn't have the resources. It didn't have the people. You couldn't get a timely appointment for somebody to be looked at quickly and helped to be put back on the path towards recovery. And now it's blown out the water. And yes, the government's put more money in, which is very welcome. But, you know, if you want to get an appointment to see a psychologist, you'll be looking at a minimum of 3 months, maybe six in some areas, depending on where you live.
Wow.
So it's not working. We can't afford just to keep fixing people when they need help because they've fallen in a hole. We need to be moving everybody into a new place at home and at work to the normal being, I know that my employer values me and cares for me sufficiently to ensure that I have, one, a safe working environment where it feels safe to speak up and share how I'm actually feeling. Shock, horror. Because, you know, when we're not very good at that yet, but we will get better. The more we practice it, the easier it becomes. And secondly, to, you know, lead by example, where instead of this notion of you can only be successful if you work harder than everybody else and put in ridiculous hours and sacrifice everything else in your life in order to achieve that, that's got to go because it's damaging us, it's hurting us, and it's killing us. I mean, death from overwork is a real thing. We don't acknowledge it here in Australia, but it exists.
Especially in that entrepreneurial space as well, where you hear the word hustle and all those sorts of catch cries that get thrown around. And I'm personally of the view that I'm a bit of an anti-hustle. I think there should be an anti-hustle movement.
I'm with you on, Jesse. Yes, let's go and march around.
Yeah, I know, because I know it's kind of almost like the entrepreneurial badge of honor to talk about, perhaps not in dentistry or medicine, I slept under my desk kind of routine and here I am, but I've got a squillion dollars at the end of it. But for what? There has to be some sort of, as you say, balance. There's got, and if you're not getting that balance right, then there's a trade-off or a sacrifice that's being made. And the question is that really worth it?
Yeah, I mean, some of my patients when I was in practice would come in and say, oh, I really love Dr. So-and-so. He's so caring. He was in on the ward at 11 o'clock at night to see everybody to make sure we were okay. And then the next morning he was back at six again to do a quick ward round before he had to go off and do his surgery or whatever he was doing. And I'm thinking, oh, no.
Oh, bugger. Yeah.
Yes. But, of course, that perpetuates the myth of the superhero.
It does.
And we've got to let go of the superhero because the superhero doesn't exist.
It's really interesting that you say that. In the work that I do, I work with some wonderful dentists, and we've basically this year had to put a bit of a boundary in because I'm the worst at keeping boundaries, not because of any of the people that we work with, but because I need to protect me from me. And we've had to put a boundary in place where Jesse doesn't do after-hours appointments anymore, because what I found is that I was not turning off.
Yeah.
I was not decompressing at the end of the day. I'd be forever on. Yes. And so, again, I know that I'm my own worst enemy in that. So, thankfully, my lovely team have taken matters into their own hands and said, we want you to be a nice boss. And so, therefore, this is how it's going to be. And that's really great. Not everyone has that person or someone who's going to put the boundaries in place for them. So I guess it's up to us to put those boundaries in place.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you about boundaries.
Yes.
Firstly, I'd love to get your view on boundaries, but I'd also like to get your perspective on how to set and keep boundaries when someone pushes up against them.
I did tell you I was a recovering workaholic, didn't I?
Yes, me too.
And so boundaries was something that I'd never had, didn't need them. What do you need boundaries? What are you talking about?
I know.
So boundaries was something that I had to learn, and it's still a work in progress because those internal drivers take a while to sort out. And for years, I always gave myself permission because I could, just to say, well, I'll just stay a little bit longer and do that extra report that needs writing up or stuff like that. And my husband would be on the phone saying, are you coming home soon? Because it was 8 o'clock at night and I hadn't left the surgery. So boundaries, everybody else had gone home. The lights were out apart from in my office. So yes, boundaries. I'm still working on getting better at not working on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't take work home so much. I did it more on the weekends rather than the evenings. But because I was the principal and also the business manager, I was the one doing the rosters for when people were working. I was doing all the pays and everything else like that.
Oh, wow.
And so that would consume my weekends. So when did I have time off? What was time off? How do I switch? And the switching off piece, you know, when you go to bed and you're still thinking about work and you wake up and the first thing you're thinking about is, what have I got on today? Who am I seeing? And what's, yeah. So learning to switch off can be a challenge. And I think it does make a huge difference if you've got somebody to help you with that.
Mm.
My receptionist used to put in fictional patient names in my schedule.
Bless her.
Yeah. And they didn't let on. And after a little while, I said, how come this woman, she seems to be booked in quite frequently, but I never see her. And that's when they were rumbled. And it was basically just to give me a breathing space. So yeah. I could maybe go to the bathroom or have another cup of tea or something. And my husband is very good at reminding me about boundaries. And my close friends are now, because they know me well enough, say, Jenny, you're not walking your talk. You need to stop working. And what's interesting is over the 2020 COVID time, when work was turned upside down and inside out and all my speaking engagements and my workshops got cancelled, I had much more time on my hands to switch off and not work weekends. And you know what? I loved it. And because I loved it so much, that made it easier to keep that habit going. But I had to experience it first to make it a longer-term goal.
Wow. Isn't that fantastic? And again, this is what I refer to, and I say this very consciously that this is going to sound glib, and I don't mean it at all glibly, but that is the gift of COVID. Clearly, there's been some horrendous outcomes from COVID as well, so I don't want to make light of that. But if there is a gift, it is those sorts of things that come out of it. I wanted to also, just while we're on the topic of boundaries, I want to talk about obligation because they seem to go hand in hand a little bit. And I know this is probably getting a little bit away from your core work, but I'm just curious to understand because, again, I know that there's lots of people who have been through burnout. There's lots of people who are not really good at boundaries and they stay back late at night. They see that person in their lunch hour after work. And then there's a team member that needs to see them about something. And then there's a referral to write. And then there's always this stuff. It's like the job is never done.
Yeah,
exactly. In essence.
Yeah.
And so you could give it all day, every day, and still not complete it. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about obligation around that, because I think obligation and boundaries are almost two sides of a coin. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts around resisting other people's obligations.
This is where I think determining for yourself what your boundary is. So if you decide, I am going to leave work by 6 o'clock every night, that is my boundary, then you have to tell other people what your new boundary is, because they have learned to understand that they will ask you to do something and you will always say, oh, of course, and you'll do it because you can. But only by outlining your boundaries and then sharing those with others, whether it's your family or with your work colleagues, and saying, this is how I now operate. This is my operating system. Please don't ask me to go beyond that unless it's an absolute dire emergency. Then people start to respect your boundaries. But unless you tell them, they won't. So the obligation piece then, otherwise, because, and then that perpetuates the obligation piece. I feel obliged to, because, you know, little Johnny's got a terrible earache and his mum's really worried about him. How could you possibly not see him? Well, maybe, and it's 6 o'clock. So maybe you do have a colleague who's working with you who could see little Johnny, or maybe there's an after-hours clinic that you can direct them to that's just a couple of kilometres down the road or something. It's that self-permission piece and then giving other people permission to adhere to your boundaries. That's that deals with the obligation, which otherwise morphs into perpetual.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing you say is you can help people by not actually being the person to do it as well. You can direct people, and that's being helpful too. So I really appreciate that. I wanted to talk to you about dealing with stress and anxiety and how to reduce it specifically.
Yeah.
Obviously, during COVID, there's been uncertainty. And when there's uncertainty, typically stress levels ratchet up a bit.
Mm.
We need to have, as human beings, we like predictability to an extent. We like a bit of uncertainty, of course, for adventure and variety. But at the same time, that bit of predictability is good. And when that's taken away, largely stress and anxiety do increase. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about how do you thrive in uncertain times, or how do you reduce that stress and anxiety?
I think this is sort of where inward reflection is very important, and to understand yourself better so that you can accept yourself better. Because the self-acceptance piece is about acknowledging that what stresses me may not stress other people to the same extent, and even given the circumstance, that sort of thing. But then to tune into, okay, rather than resisting that and allowing the stress and anxiety to get bigger, because the more we try to suppress those feelings, they actually get more intense and grow. And that's because of our fantastic neuroplastic brain as well. The more we ruminate on things, the more we're strengthening those thought patterns. And by stepping back and saying, yeah, you know what, I'm feeling a bit anxious today, more so than usual, and asking yourself, well, what's worked in the past? What could I do right now? And what else am I willing to try to help alleviate this? And that just sort of immediately lessens that emotional reaction to my stress. And the psychologists will say, look, as soon as you are able to verbalize the emotion that you're experiencing, that automatically re-engages your prefrontal cortex to help you to dampen down that emotional response and to regain control over how you're behaving at that particular moment. And from a personal perspective, just reminding myself that all feelings are temporary is enormously helpful, because when we're in that horrible space, it feels like it's all pervasive and it's going to go on forever. And of course it doesn't. So if we can get through this particular moment using the strategies that we've tried and tested or want to give a go, because we're thinking we've got to try something, then that will help to alleviate that. And it's, everybody has their own individual toolbox, as I call it, of different things that they would use. For me, I use mindfulness. I like mindfulness meditation. I found that very grounding, but I understand too, not everybody likes that. And sometimes it's just simple breathing. So I teach lots of people different breathing exercises, which, because everybody is normally breathing, they
one
can
would
do
hope. One would
and
hope.
They're practiced, you know, they've been breathing all their lives. So it's just, you know, using, you know, our parasympathetic nervous system to dampen down that intensity of emotion that goes with the high levels of stress that enable us to sort of settle down our thinking and our behaviors so that we retain that sense of control. The other thing that I find essential is being outside. I mentioned before, you know, when I was recovering from burnout, just going for a daily walk. It's part of my routine. It's part of who I am, because it makes me feel good. As soon as I go outside and I'm on the path, or we're down the beach or in the park or wherever, it's just that, whew. And we know that as soon as you're in a green space, it elevates your mood. And we know that if you're moving at the same time, you're stimulating the release of those feel-good hormones such as dopamine and serotonin and endorphins. And of course, if you're with somebody else as well, you're also boosting your oxytocin level. So you're feeling that sense of connection with somebody else. And that's helpful too, because I don't know what if you've experienced this yourself, maybe some of your listeners have, but when you're feeling really stressed, it's as if you're the only person going through that sensation at that particular time. You feel very alone.
Totally. I think I can definitely relate to that. I have experienced that sense of stress and anxiety in a certain circumstance. You know, that I can't even remember specifically what it was, but feeling that sense of, but also Yeah, it's almost like you're in your own little room and you could have someone standing right there, but you're just not present. You're not available to them, and they're not available to you in a sense as well. Quite an interesting dynamic.
So that's where being with somebody, and to remember too, especially if you're the person who's with the person who's really struggling with a lot of stress, or that, and then they're clearly distressed, you don't need to be talking at them.
No.
Just sitting there in silence is actually hugely beneficial. Sometimes we feel the need to fill that void. I better say something to help them to feel better.
Yeah.
And it's often the wrong thing. And it's not what we need. We just need that knowledge that somebody's there who cares enough about us just to be with us.
Yeah.
And just to listen to anything that we have to share and not to try and fix us.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think sometimes, you know, we all rush to solution, don't we? And I think, I don't know about you, but I know as dentists, we are all prone to want to fix stuff. People come in with a problem, let's fix it. And so when we're trying to listen, sometimes we rush to, let me fix that for you. I've certainly been guilty of that. But here's my 10-point plan for how I can get you better in the next 5 minutes. And it's not always helpful, as you say. Sometimes it's better to just keep my mouth closed and sit and listen. I wanted to ask you about the concept of mental well-being versus mental illness. And I wanted to ask you, I was doing some training with a gentleman from the UK, actually, a guy, John Parr, and he was talking about what he felt the natural state of the brain, or the natural mood, the default mood setting, was one of happiness. And I don't know whether you agree or disagree with that, but I wanted to explore the concept of a default setting.
Yes.
Is there a default setting for most of us? I know, I understand individual variation, et cetera, but I'm wondering, is there a default setting for us?
We've all got a sort of range rather than a precise setting of how we feel on a day-to-day basis, whether you call that happiness or whatever. I don't think matters, but we all have that little range which nudges up or down according to circumstance and how we respond to things. So we can, because the work by the positive psychologists has indicated that seeking to remain in a more positive state can be helpful to us to find greater happiness. It's not about being happy, clappy, happy all the time. Let's dance around the campfire. This is about that deeper. And so I'm qualifying the happiness word to that deeper sense of joy, calm, awe, wonder, those other positive emotions that we tend not to go for quite as often, but are actually inherently part of our overall happiness level.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess then the question that comes from that is, if your default level is something that you're wanting to improve,
yes,
it's going to come back to some of those practices we spoke about a bit earlier.
And the thing about the practices is they have to be intentional. For somebody recovering from anxiety, panic, depression, it is the intentional activities that you put in place, and they're usually quite small, on a daily basis that will help to shift your state of mind to find a more positive space.
I think that's really interesting.
So it's not about saying, right, I'm going to become vegan, I'm going to go and run a marathon, I'm going to do all these things. No. It's about recognizing what would work for you and start with, keep the bar low and go slow.
Yeah.
Because what we're trying to do is shift your behavioral response.
Yeah.
And that takes time
and
practice, lots and lots and lots of practice.
I've tried the vegan thing. I was going so well until I smelt bacon, and I'm about to get some hate mail from the vegans just for that comment. But no, I actually really like the idea of it.
Yeah.
But then when the bacon smell comes, I'm gone. I'm just so all the good intentions evaporate.
Yeah.
But I really like the idea of micro practices, and I like the idea of just doing those small things and trying to form some habits and I guess almost rituals around some of those things if that's necessary. But yeah, getting into that habitual state of doing those little things consistently and well. And then I guess it's probably also a case of habit stacking as well, as you get one thing going well, yeah, whatever it might be. Maybe it's getting out into nature, maybe it's a bit of mindfulness, whatever it is, but then layering the next one on top.
That's right. I mean, that's where it sounds like you've read the same book as I have, James Clear's book, Atomic Habits.
Atomic Habits. I haven't read that one actually, but I've read lots of habits books, but yes. Yeah,
I think he's one of the best in that sphere, because that's exactly what he's talking about. Looking for the opportunity to slide that new habit in on top of an existing thing that you do, because it makes it easier to make it stick. And keeping them small, because again, you're increasing your likelihood of success.
Mm.
Because we don't break habits. We have to supersede our existing way of doing with a new route by laying down that new neural pathway in our brains. And then with the practice and the repetition over and over and over and over and over, strengthening that new neural pathway until it becomes your new default pathway, so that the habit becomes more established. And that can take a very variable length of time, depending on your level of interest, how often you're practicing, how big the change is, and all that sort of thing. But I find that's quite fascinating, how we can literally rewire our thinking to find ways that serve us better.
What I find really lovely about that whole practice is the concept of being intentional. And that process of self-examination. If there'll be people, as I said at the beginning, listening to this program who are working really hard, type A perfectionists, either on the path to burnout or at least vulnerable to being on the path to burnout, because that's often the type of cohort that make up our profession. Yeah. And I say that with care and kindness, because I've burned out myself. And what I'm really noticing about this conversation is it's about being aware of that. It's about being able to critically analyze what's working and what's not, and then being intentional about some of those changes that you bring in slowly, methodically, one little habit at a time, as we've spoken about. And doing that over time yields big results.
Absolutely, it does. And just to build on that slightly, I think when we're so tied up and caught up in our busy world of overwork and overcommitment, we forget to press the pause button occasionally to step back and just sit and think, how am I tracking? We don't. Mm. I call it our thinking space.
Mm.
Make an appointment with yourself every week. It doesn't have to be very long, 10, 15 minutes, just to reflect, how's this week been? What's going well? What isn't going well? Mm. What needs to change? And it's just that inward reflection piece that actually can give us the insights that we otherwise don't see.
It's really interesting. One of the things I've tried to take on this year, and this is, I'd love to say it was my own good idea, but it wasn't. It was someone giving me some advice, but I'll share it with you because maybe there's something in there. But what I've tried to do this year, that in COVID, you mentioned that you had the opportunity to sit and reflect and to slow down to an extent. Mm. My experience of COVID was the opposite. Our business went into overdrive trying to support people and so on. And so I don't think I've worked that hard for a very long time, and probably got into some bad habits in a sense. All those boundaries that we're talking about before just gone.
Yep.
But this year, as I said, we've really tried to reestablish some things. And one of the things I've done this year, to speak to your point about making an appointment with yourself, is I've booked a week off by myself every quarter.
Wow.
And much to my wife's chagrin, and she's like, what do you mean I'm not invited? Well, in the nicest way, you can go and do that too. And I'm happy not to be invited, but I'm just taking a week for myself once a quarter where it's just me.
Yeah.
And I disappear to the beach. I take my book and I do whatever. I did it last year around September time, and it was the best thing I've done for myself in terms of self-care. So just in terms of appointments, I don't know if that's going to suit everyone, but it works for me.
Yeah, it's finding what does work for you. And again, I mean, if you're the sort of person who needs that that still time to restore and replenish. And as an introvert, I can highly relate to that because that's what I do too. You know, I love being with people, but I need my own space too. And I can totally relate to taking that time out. I haven't tried it yet. I might. You've sown the seed of something now, Jesse.
Tell me how it goes, Jenny. I honestly think I had a week when I went to a place called Kiama last. It's south coast of New South Wales, south of Wollongong. Loved it, Jenny. Honestly, it was the happiest thing. I'd get up, I'd have breakfast, go for a walk. I'd do some meditation, come home. It was fantastic. And it was guilt-free. It was just total guilt-free and it was lovely. So anyway, but yes, the introverts, those of us who are introverts say unite and have a little bit of quiet time. I've got a lot of friends who are extroverts, so they just go, I couldn't think of anything worse.
Yeah, that'd be torture for them.
Horrible. But for those of us who really enjoy that bit of quiet time, it's probably lovely. Yeah. Jenny, we've covered a lot of material today and you've been incredibly generous with your time, your knowledge, your expertise. And what I really want to say to you is the fact that you've been able to share so openly your own story, busy medical practitioner, running that practice and all that that entails, and then to go on your own journey of burnout, but discovery as well, and to be able to turn that into something productive that's helpful for other people. Thank you. Because if it hadn't been turned into something productive and helpful, then, I mean, that would just be your experience and now other people get to benefit from it. I know that you're going to be doing a mental wellbeing course. We spoke about that before, and that's coming up in May.
Yes.
There'll be some people on this podcast that might be interested to find out more about that or what's involved.
Sure.
Can you give us just a quick synopsis? And then if someone wants to find out more about that, how do we let them know about that?
Okay. It's an online 8-week course, which you can do at your own pace. And obviously it's available ongoing beyond the 8 weeks. So basically it's a mixture of different topics each week, which will be provided in a video format, followed up by a live group session with me and everybody else talking for about an hour about that week's particular topic. There'll be some homework and some extra resources and readings so people can dive in and take what they need. So I'm going to be running it over, as I say, an 8-week period, and I'm in the process of sort of uploading it all at the moment and creating the videos. So if anybody's interested, all they need to do at the moment is maybe email me, jenny@drjennybrookes.com, and I'll just put them on the list for people who are interested to find out a bit more when I've got something more concrete to tell them. So that's the easiest. And I'll also be putting it up on my website when I've got the landing page finished, which will be in a couple of weeks' time.
Perfect. And for those people that want to get a copy of your book, all the usual outlets, I know you can get it from your website.
Yeah, they can get a signed copy if they do it from my website.
Well, there we go.
Or, yes, they can buy it online, or if they've got a real live bookshop that they can go to, they should be able to get it from there too. It's available as a soft copy and also as an ebook at the moment.
Perfect. A real life bookshop. That almost sounds quaint, doesn't it?
But it does, yes.
But I love bookshops. So I've seen your book in bookshops and I really recommend it. So ladies and gents, if you've been listening to today's show and you want to find out more about Jenny's work, which I highly, highly commend, I think we can't be good for our patients, our team, if we're not good for ourselves. And that self-care, that self-love, that self-everything is critical. And my personal view is that no one can do that for us. We've got to take charge of that ourselves and we can't outsource that. So please do take Jenny up on that offer. Get on that mailing list for the mental wellbeing course if that's something you'd like to do, or go and grab a copy of her book. I really recommend all of those resources. And on top of that, have a noodle around the website. There's a bunch of stuff there. There's a blog, there's resources, there's variety of different things there that you can go and explore and become familiar with Jenny's work as well. So Jenny, once again, thank you so much for taking the time today. You're an absolute gem and I really appreciate you sharing so openly and freely about how to have a thriving mind.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.